This is Urban Nation with Rick Hawk.
Brought to you by APTN. It's TV and something bigger.
All right, good afternoon and welcome to the Monday, July 11th edition of Urban Nation. I'm Rick Hart. Coming up on today's session of the UN, media literacy. We get a quick lesson in decoding pop culture and all the ways it's used to sell us stuff. And Google Plus. It promises to be a new way of navigating the web, so we turn to our interactive expert, David Pensado, to help us navigate Google+. And Classified, learn how the Canadian rapper bypassed major labels to become a true indie success story in his own right. All that coming up, plus APTN and National News lets us know what they're chasing for tonight's telecast. Some late-breaking stories to tell you about there. All that and more, including some great music. We started off with Gucci Mane and Lemonade right here on Streets 104.7.
Urban Nation.
4-7. And welcome back to Urban Nation. I'm Rick Hart. Now, to some adults, kids and teens need to be sheltered from the mainstream media in order to protect them from so-called toxic content. But my next guest believes it's better to empower young people with the right tools to let them cut through the drivel and the disturbing content themselves. Dr. Özlem Sensoy is an assistant professor of education at Simon Fraser University, and she joins me from BC. Hello.
Hi, Rick.
Now, you've just written a piece for an online magazine called the Taiyi.ca in their media check section. It's entitled Schlockproof Your Child, Three Ways to Help Kids Build Critical Minds, Their Best Defense Against Bad Media. What motivated you to write the article? I understand it has something to do with, well, I guess it's summer vacation, right?
That's right. Last week was the start of summer vacation for a lot of kids, and like many adults, taking it easy means spending a lot more time with media, spending a lot more time at the movies, playing with toys that you buy at the toy store, listening to your favorite music, going to concerts, watching TV. And so that was the motivation to write the piece. And a lot of parents, but I think a lot of us, are starting to get increasingly concerned about what's going on with media, because there is just so much of it, and there's, in relation to that, a very little amount of media literacy education going on in schools.
For people who aren't maybe familiar with the concept of media literacy, can you give us a quick example and description of what that entails?
Sure. Literacy is a term that scholars use in education mostly to talk about all the ways in which we decode the messages around us. So there's mathematical literacy, sometimes called numeracy, referring to the ability to understand mathematical concepts. There's the literacy around reading and writing that we're familiar with. And media literacy, it refers to the skills related in understanding and decoding media messages and thinking about those messages critically.
Yeah, because often I think, people, they go see a movie or they play a video game or watch TV or whatever screen-based form of entertainment or culture they're consuming at the moment, maybe not always realizing, that there are other things going on at the same time. The images don't just sort of exist in isolation. Sometimes they're selling a product, and sometimes in more subtle ways than obvious.
It's a really good observation, Rick. One of the things that that I hear a lot when I'm talking about media literacy is it's just entertainment. You know, lighten up. Why are you getting so serious about some movie or some toy? And while it might be entertainment, and we're certainly entertained by the movies that we see, educational research shows us that it's also doing something else. It's also teaching us something. And I can give you a quick example. There was a teacher in New York who wrote a fantastic article in which she tells a story about asking her fourth grade students, can anyone name a famous Native American? And this is just sort of a prompt to get her started into a new unit with the kids. And all the hands go up, and she calls on one kid who says, Pocahontas. And all the other hands in the classroom go down. And what this says to me and illustrates really starkly is not just that all the kids know Disney's movie, but that there's something that they connect to a real world, that they connect this fictional Pocahontas character from Disney to a real famous Native American in real life in the historical context that they think they know. That's really powerful. In a more sort of contemporary example, the Tulip Nation, I think a lot of us would probably know of and are maybe awaiting the next release, release of the Twilight films. The Tulip Nation has experienced a great deal of attention, and since the first Twilight film came out, I'm forgetting what year, it was a few years ago, and yet there are a lot of gray areas. So while on the one hand there's been a great deal of attention to certain tribal communities within Washington State and throughout the Pacific Northwest coast, at the same time there's a whole pedagogy going on in which a whole world of young people who are fans of the Twilight franchise are getting an education about what it means to think about Native people in this particular community in certain kinds of ways that are created by people outside of that community.
Okay, let's talk about media literacy as a way to empower young people to be more critical, I guess you could say, not to entirely spoil the experience of enjoying a movie or a television show or a game, but talk about some of the insidious ways that I guess stories don't just tell, they actually end up kind of selling to young people. You have identified three ways to kind of schlock-proof young people, as it were. Talk about those one at a time.
Sure. So these are three of many, many, many ways that we can practice some critical thinking around media literacy. So the first is, I call it turning kids into data detectives, or becoming a data detective yourself, which is just developing a consciousness about noticing what's on the screen. So many of us might talk about the ads we see between segments of a program that we're watching on TV and think that that's when we're being sold stuff, which is true. That's when advertisers are using that time to sell us things. But more and more, there's a lot of product placement going on within the show, and a lot of corporations will pay to have their vehicles, their watches, their cell phones featured in a particular show. The James Bond series is infamous for this. You know, there's a close-up on his watch. There's a close-up on the Mercedes vehicles that are pulling up. And it, of course, it isn't the only one. So one of the things that anyone can do is to start tracking and seeing how much of that you can spot. How much product placement can you spot? In the old days, it used to be that names would be blocked out. So instead of, Coca-Cola, the can would be blanked out and it would just say cola or something funny like that. But Coca-Cola is featured prominently in a lot of shows like American Idol is a good example.
Yeah, they pay big bucks for those product placements.
Absolutely. So kids can do this and do this really well, and it's like a hunting and seeking game. And I think once we as adults also practice training ourselves to see it, it can be a really powerful thing to start to see all the ways in which we're being sold all kinds of things.
Okay, something else you also talk about is to have young people should start tracking transmedia intertextuality. Unpackage that for us.
I know, it's a really clunky term, like a lot of academic terms, but it basically just means all the ways in which texts are connected. So, for example, if there's a movie being released like Green Lantern or Shrek or some other movie that's targeting, or Twilight, some other movie that's targeting a particular audience, you will start to see products in places outside of that movie. So if you go to the store, if you go to Zellers or Walmart or one of these large chain stores, you will see the shoelaces, the T-shirts, and the backpacks, and the bed sheets, and sometimes even, it's amazing all of the places in which Green Lantern or Twilight is sold to you outside of the movie. So you might expect that you'd see, a CD or a DVD. But I've seen Hannah Montana deodorant and you know, glitter fingernail polish that's branded. And so that's a way in which kids can also track how that intertextuality is working in all of the places that they go to, whether it's a McDonald's store and they get a Happy Meal toy or a special glass or something, to every other location that they go with their parents or that we go. And the movie kind of follows us around in a way.
And finally, you also talk about identifying cases of age compression. Again, can you define what that means and illustrate that?
Sure. Age compression is a marketing term, and it describes this idea of expanding the market share by pushing adult products onto younger and younger consumers. This happens, a really explicit example of this is the selling of makeup or lingerie to girls at younger and younger ages. So girls who are prepubescent, for example, might not need padded bras or eyeliners or lip glosses, but the marketing machinery pushes these products onto girls at younger and younger ages. So age compression refers to that phenomenon, and it's starting to become more and more pervasive, and I think that's also something that kids can track. So what is squeezed out is sort of a question that I ask in the piece, and I think it's a really important question for us all to think about. What's squeezed out when kids are asked to play out the roles of the adult world at younger and younger ages? So paying attention to all the ways in which age compression works around us. In the magazines that we read, what kind of stories and concerns are young people presumed to have? Are they adult world concerns that are about work and competition and independence, or are they something else? So age compression is a good word to get used to describing, because it helps us connect the media and pop culture we consume to marketing activities that are around that pop culture.
Well, you know, I'm glad to see somebody taking an approach that doesn't assume young people don't have the inherent capacity to deal with these things on their own. And it's good to see that you're trying to empower them and give them some credit, I guess.
Thanks, Rick. We know that kids as young as 3 and probably even younger are able to do all kinds of transgressive things. I know many of us know lots of little kids who cut up their dolls and play with their toys in ways that were not intended by the adults around them. And, they're not agentless, and they're not naive, and certainly not disengaged. So summer pop culture is sort of perfect time to practice doing all this.
All right, take care and enjoy your summer's worth of entertainment.
Thanks, Rick. You too.
Dr. Özlem Sensoy is a professor in the Faculty of Education at Simon Fraser University. She's also co-editor of the book Rethinking Popular Culture and Media. We'll have a link to the Tai article that she wrote off of our Facebook page, facebook.com/UrbanNationLive. Stay tuned. More to come on the UN.
Urban Nation.